efforts to take up her own cause in a mature and articulate manner. Her tears and her willingness to let her boss play the role of adviser and confidant were, in part, her unconscious way of reinstating the status quo and apologizing for the separateness inherent in her initial position of disagreement. Karen's tears may also have been an unconscious attempt to make her boss feel guilty. "See how you've hurt me," a frequent practice for women who are blocked from making a direct statement of where we stand. "But I'm not angry about it anymore," protested Karen. "It just doesn't matter." Of course Karen is still angry. She just doesn't recognize it. Anger is inevitable when we submit to unfair circumstances and when we protect another person at our own expense. Karen's denial of her anger and her failure to stand behind her position had inevitable costs. She felt tired and less enthusiastic at work. 2 weeks after her evaluation, Karen misplaced a folder of important forms, and she was seriously reprimanded. This self-sabotaging act was perhaps an unconscious attempt to put herself in the role of the bad guy, who did not really deserve the superior evaluation. Rather than stand firm in her opinion that her boss had failed to give her the evaluation that she believed she deserved. Denying anger. The unconscious in action. Have you ever initiated a confrontation at work, only to transform your anger into tears, apologies, guilt, confusion, or self-criticism? Karen's behavior may well strike a familiar, if not universal, chord among women. How can we better understand some of the deeper, unconscious reasons why any of us would attempt to deny our anger and sacrifice one of our most precious possessions, our personal clarity? The fear of destructiveness. Karen's failure to defend her position in an articulate and persistent fashion with her boss was a pattern in her personal relationships as well. The explanations that she gave herself were just the tip of the iceberg. "I get intimidated. I just can't think straight when I'm dealing with an authority figure. I guess I don't have faith in my own convictions." Karen did lose her confidence when her ideas were not given the stamp of other people's approval, but this lack of confidence masked a more serious problem. Karen was afraid to be clear about the correctness of her position because she would then experience pressure to continue to take up her own cause. And to do this might make her the target of her boss's anger and disapproval. As Karen put it, a real fight might ensue. This idea frightened Karen, partly for realistic reasons, such as the possibility that her work situation would become difficult and uncomfortable, or that she might even be fired. Surely, fighting would escalate the tensions between Karen and her boss, make it even less likely that she would be heard. Reality aside, however, Karen had a deep unconscious fear that fighting might unleash her fantasied destructive potential, although it had never seen the light of day. If she lost control of her anger, would she destroy everything? It was as if Karen feared that the full venting of her outrage might cause the entire office building to go up in flames. Also, like most women, Karen had little practice expressing her anger in a controlled, direct, and effective fashion. It is not surprising that Karen had deep-seated fears of her own omnipotent destructiveness and the vulnerability of men. Our very definitions of masculinity and femininity are based on the notion that women must function as non-threatening helpmates and ego-builders to men, lest men feel castrated and weakened. The problem for Karen was that this irrational fear had a high cost. Not only did she avoid fighting, she also avoided asserting her viewpoint, requesting explanations from others, and stating her wants. All of the above fell into the category of potentially destructive acts that might hurt or diminish others. The fear of separateness. As much as Karen feared a volcanic eruption, she had an even greater fear, also safely tucked away in her subconscious. Karen was afraid of transforming her anger into concise statements of her thoughts and feelings, lest she evoke that disturbing sense of separateness and aloneness that we experience when we make our differences known and encourage others to do the same. Maggie, for example, felt this separation anxiety when she talked with her mother about her baby in a new, more adult way. Sandra felt it when she apologized to Larry for being so critical and assumed more responsibility to provide for her own happiness. Barbara would have felt it had she stopped fighting and calmly told her husband that she planned to go to the anger workshop. Separation anxiety may creep up on us whenever we shift to a more autonomous, non-blaming position in a relationship, or even when we simply consider the possibility. Sometimes such anxiety is based on a realistic fear that if we assume a bottom-line stance, "I'm sorry, but I will not do what you're asking of me," we risk losing a relationship or a job. More often, and more crucially, separation anxiety is based on an underlying discomfort with separateness and individuality that has its roots in our early family experience, where the unspoken expectation may have been that we keep a lid on our expressions of self. Daughters are especially sensitive to such demands and may become far more skilled at protecting the relational we than asserting the autonomous I. Karen was not aware of her separation anxiety, but it led her to transform her initially clear and strong position into tears and hurt. Expressing hurt allowed her boss to be helpful and restored her sense of connectedness to him, which made her feel safe despite the self-betrayal involved in this transformation. Karen had a long-standing pattern of attempting to restore the togetherness of her relationships by crying, criticizing herself, becoming confused, or prematurely making peace. At the heart of the problem was the fact that Karen, like Maggie in Chapter 4, needed to work harder at the task of clarifying her separateness and independence within her first family. If Karen can stay in contact with family members and make progress in this arena, she will find that she will proceed more effectively when she is angry at work and with less fear of standing separate and alone on her own 2 feet. Moving differently. If Karen were to do it all over again, how might she transform her anger into productive action? First, she can better prepare herself to deal with her boss's counter-moves, which in this case consisted of his indirectly criticizing her work and deflecting her from the issue. Karen shouldn't try to change or control his reactions, which is not possible anyway, nor should she allow herself to be controlled by them. She can simply stay on course by listening to what he has to say and then restating her initial position. There's nothing wrong with sounding like a broken record now and then. What if Karen starts to feel tearful or emotionally intense during the interaction? If this happens, she can take time out to regain her composure. She can say, "I need a little time to sort my thoughts out. Let's set up another time to talk more about it." What if her supervisor refuses to consider changing the evaluation? Karen can then begin to give some thought to her next move. She may request a third party to review her evaluation. She may simply say to her boss, "I don't like it, but I can live with it." She may ask for specific instructions on how she might secure a superior evaluation the next time around. No matter how skilled Karen becomes in handling her anger, she cannot make her boss change his mind or ensure that justice will prevail. She can state her position, recognize her choices, and make responsible decisions on her own behalf. The calmer and clearer that Karen can be with her boss, the clearer he will become about his own perspective on the evaluation and what he will and will not do. Could it be that Karen unconsciously preferred to avoid this kind of clarity so as to maintain the image of her boss as a good guy? Karen's story illustrates how our unconscious fears of destructiveness and of separateness may block us from maintaining our clarity and using our anger as a challenge to take a new position or action on our own behalf. In some instances, however, our problem is not the fear of clarity, but the absence of it. That we are angry is obvious, but we may have little perspective on the I, as a result of focusing exclusively on what the other person is doing to us. Here is a personal example. The frying pan story. During a visit some years ago from my older sister Susan, the two of us set off to Macy's, where I planned to buy a non-stick frying pan. Without much forethought, I picked up a pan that looked fine to me and began to head over to the cashier. Before I could take two steps, my sister informed me that I was buying the wrong pan. Not only did the tone of Susan's voice express supreme confidence in her own judgment, but her advice was accompanied by a rather detailed and technical account regarding the problems with the particular finish I had selected, a subject about which I knew nothing and cared even less. My initial reaction was to be once again impressed by my big sister's encyclopedic mind. But as she continued on, I felt a growing anger. Who asked her for her opinion? Why did she always think she was right? Why did she behave like the world's expert on all subjects? I briefly toyed with the idea of bopping her on the head with the pan I had in hand, but resisted the impulse. Instead, I marched over to the cashier like a sullen and rebellious little sister and paid for the pan I had chosen myself. It proved to be of poor quality and short-lived, just as Susan had predicted. An old saying tells us, "We teach what we most need to learn." When I was recounting the incident to my friend Marianne Alt-Richet, who conducts anger workshops with me, I was as far from personal clarity as any person could be. Why was I angry? The answer was simple. Because my sister was so difficult. She had caused my anger by her opinionated style and by her need to be an expert on all matters. Everything I said to Marianne about my anger was a statement about my sister, not one word about my own self. Marianne listened and then responded lightly. "I'd love to take your sister shopping along with me. I would have been fascinated to learn about different types of non-stick cookware. Susan is so knowledgeable." Marianne was speaking honestly. If she had been in my shoes, her reaction to Susan's knowledge and personality would have been entirely positive. Indeed, the very qualities that I was criticizing were those that endeared Susan to certain others, my parents included. At that moment, I recognized what is so obvious to me in other people, that my blaming stance was preventing me from gaining an understanding of my heated reaction. What was it about Susan's advice-giving and expertise that annoyed me? Why was it a problem for me? What was the pattern in our relationship, and what was my participation in it? Only after I was able to reflect on these questions was I able to tell Susan what was bothering me, without implying that her personality or way of being in the world was at fault. First, I used my anger as an incentive to sort out what I wanted, and then to set a limit with my sister. As Maggie did with her mother, I clarified with Susan that I wanted her advice only when I asked for it. It was understandably difficult for Susan to accept that I would choose to avoid helpful and sound advice, since she herself would welcome it, solicited or not. To help explain the problem that I had receiving her advice, I told her a bit about my experience of being a younger sister. "You know, Susan, all my life I've seen you as a brilliant star. I've always looked up to you as the person who had all the answers. I felt you knew everything and could do anything. And I felt I was in a one-down position, like I didn't have much to teach or to offer you in return. In fact, when I feel intimidated by your brilliance, I react by becoming even less competent. Our relationship is very important to me, and I'm trying to work on getting things more in balance for myself. What I think will help me is to steer clear of my big sister's help and advice for a while. I know that may sound silly and ungrateful, because you are so good at being helpful, but that's what would be most useful to me at this time." I was, in fact, asking my sister to make a change in her behavior. However, I was asking her to make a change not because her advice-giving was bad or wrong or excessive, but rather because that would be helpful to me, in light of my reactions to big sisterly advice, reactions for which I took full responsibility. Sharing my dilemma with Susan, including my envy about her being the brilliant star in the family, was an important step in breaking out of an old, over-functioning, under-functioning pattern in which Susan was in the role of the competent helper and I in that of the less competent helpee. In the past, the more Susan expressed enough wisdom and competence for the two of us, the more I would react by de-selfing myself into a state of conspicuous fuzzy-headedness. As I verbalized my wish to be able to provide something for my sister, rather than always being on the receiving end of her big sisterly wisdom, Susan responded by sharing some of her problems with me. And it became evident to me for the first time that she valued my perspective. Over time, our relationship became more balanced, and I no longer felt myself to be at the bottom of the seesaw. Today, I do value her advice, solicited or not, on any number of subjects, non-stick cookware included. Using our anger as a starting point to become more knowledgeable about the self does not require that we analyze ourselves and provide lengthy psychological explanations of our reactions, as I did with Susan. If I had not identified some long-standing relationship issues, I might simply have told my sister that I didn't want advice and really wasn't clear about why. The essential ingredient of this story is that I used my anger to clarify a request based on my own personal wants, and not because I sought to become an uninvited authority on how Susan should best conduct herself. Anger is a tool for change when it challenges us to become more of an expert on the self and less of an expert on others. Taking a firm stand. Learning to use our anger effectively requires some letting go. Letting go of blaming that other person whom we see as causing our problems and failing to provide for our happiness. Letting go of the notion that it is our job to change other people or tell them how they should think, feel, behave. Yet this does not mean that we passively accept or go along with any behavior. In fact, a live-and-let-live attitude can signal a de-selfed position if we fail to clarify what is and is not acceptable or desirable to us in a relationship. The main issue is how we clarify our position. Recently, I worked with a woman named Ruth, who was furious over her husband's neglect of his health. He had received poor medical treatment for a serious leg problem that was worsening, and he had no plans to seek further help. Ruth expressed her anger by lecturing him on what he should do for himself and interpreting his feelings and behavior. "You're being self-destructive. You're neglecting yourself the way your father did. You're denying your own fears," etc. Her husband, in response, adopted an increasingly bland attitude toward his problem, which was understandable, since his wife was voicing enough worry for both of them, and became more dogmatic in his refusal to consider further treatment. It was an escalating, circular dance, in which Ruth's "I know what's best for you" attitude only intensified her husband's willful assertion of his independence on this issue, which led to longer and more frequent lectures on Ruth's part about what he should do and what he was really feeling. Like many women, Ruth was becoming the emotional reactor for her man, while he played out the role of the emotional dumbbell. It was a big step for Ruth to recognize that it was up to her husband to determine his own feelings, to choose his own risks, and to assume the primary responsibility for his own health. This was his job, not hers. But it was equally important for Ruth to take her anger seriously, to use it to clarify, first to herself and then to her husband, that she was unable to live with the status quo and go about business as usual. Ruth made an important change when she talked to her husband about her own feelings instead of criticizing and instructing him. Ruth's father had died from a degenerative illness when she was 12, and she now found herself scared of losing her husband as well. Instead of focusing on her husband's self-destructiveness or neglect, Ruth was able to request that her husband seek medical help because of her own needs and feelings. She explained that her fears and anxieties were so great that she could not go about her day-to-day activities as if nothing was happening. She did not blame her husband for her reaction, nor did she say that she knew what was best for him. Rather, Ruth was now sharing her problem with the situation and asking her husband to respect the intensity of her discomfort. He did agree to go to the doctor, although he made it perfectly clear that he was going for her sake, not his own. When we use our anger to make statements about the self, We assume a position of strength, because no one can argue with our own thoughts and feelings. They may try, but in response we need not provide logical arguments in our defense. Instead, we can simply say, "Well, it may seem crazy or irrational to you, but this is the way I see it." Of course, there is never a guarantee that other people will alter their behavior in the way that we want them to. Joan's story is illustrative. A bottom-line position. Joan and Carl had been living together for a year, and had maintained their separate friendships with both sexes. They were in agreement that they were committed to monogamy, but did not want to sacrifice the opportunity to have close friends. This informal contract proved to be workable, until Carl began spending time with his young research assistant who was in the process of going through a divorce. In response, Joan found herself feeling jealous, threatened, and angry. For almost a year, the relationship between Carl and his assistant remained the focus of non-productive fighting. Joan would question whether Carl's feelings were truly platonic, and Carl, in turn, would accuse her of being paranoid and possessive. They had countless intellectual debates regarding boundary issues. Was it appropriate for Carl's assistant to call him at home in the evening to talk about her divorce? Was it okay for Carl to have dinner with her, or just lunch? Joan shifted back and forth between blaming Carl and blaming herself, while nothing was resolved. Her recurrent anger, however, was a strong signal that despite the passage of time, she was not at peace with this relationship. The turning point came when Joan stopped complaining about Carl's behavior and stated openly that the situation was not acceptable to her. She did not criticize him for doing something bad or wrong, and she even acknowledged that another woman in her shoes might not complain, or might even welcome the opportunity to do the same herself. Joan's point was simply that she was experiencing more jealousy and anger than she could live with. When Carl interpreted her reaction as pathological and middle class, Joan did not fight or become defensive. Instead, she said, "Well, my feelings are my feelings, and I'm having such a painful reaction to your relationship with this woman that I want you to end it. It may be 99% my problem, but I'm unable to live with it and still feel okay about us. I'm just finding it too difficult." Joan upheld this position with dignity and firmness. Joan's clarity about her emotional anguish forced Carl to clarify his own priorities. And his first priority was not Joan. Carl refused to end his relationship with his research assistant. Joan, after considerable personal turmoil, finally took a bottom-line position and said, "I can't continue to live with you if you continue in this relationship." She said this not as a threat or as an attempt at emotional blackmail, but rather to share what she was experiencing and declare what was possible for her. Carl didn't respond and continued on as usual, and Joan requested that he move out. Soon afterward, Carl left Joan entirely and moved in with his research assistant. Joan suffered a great deal. However, she felt good about the position she had taken. She had lost Carl, but she had saved her dignity and self-respect. Did she do the right thing? Joan did the right thing for Joan, but some of us in her place might have chosen to do something different, or not have known what to do at all. In using our anger as a guide to determining our innermost needs, values, and priorities, we should not be distressed if we discover just how unclear we are. If we feel chronically angry or bitter in an important relationship, this is a signal that too much of the self has been compromised, and we are uncertain about what new position to take or what options we have available to us. To recognize our lack of clarity is not a weakness, but an opportunity, a challenge, and a strength. There is no reason why women should be clear about the I. Who am I? What do I want? What do I deserve? These are questions that we all struggle with, and for good reason. For too long, we have been encouraged not to question, but to accept other defined notions of our true nature, our appropriate place, our maternal responsibilities, our feminine role, and so forth. Or we've been taught to substitute other questions. How can I please others? How can I win love and approval? How can I keep the peace? We suffer most when we fail to grapple with the "who am I?" questions, and when we deny feeling the anger that signals that such questions are there for us to consider. It is an act of courage to acknowledge our own uncertainty and sit with it for a while. Too often anger propels us to take positions that we have not thought through carefully enough, or that we are not really ready to take. Nor does it help that those around us may be full of advice and encouragement to act. Leave that man already. Tell your boss that you won't do the assignment. You just can't let him treat you that way. Tell her you won't be friends with her anymore if she does that again. Just tell him no. Slow down. Our anger can be a powerful vehicle for personal growth and change if it does nothing more than help us recognize that we are not yet clear about something and that it is our job to keep struggling with it. Let us look at one woman's journey from an angry, blaming position to a productive confronting of her own confusion. Chapter 6. Up and Down, The Generations. Katie and her aging father. Katie is a 50-year-old homemaker whose youngest child has just left home for college. Her father is a 72-year-old retired teacher who has been widowed for 10 years and who is in moderately poor health. Katie called me at the Menninger Foundation because she had heard that I was an anger expert. During our initial telephone conversation, she described a pattern that has been the source of her anger for almost a decade. "My father has a big problem," she explained, with unveiled desperation in her voice. "He makes excessive demands on me, especially since he can't drive anymore, because he lost some vision following a stroke. I'm supposed to take him shopping when he calls and drive him to his appointments. He asks me to do things for him in his apartment and then criticizes me for not doing them right. There are many things he could do for himself, but he acts like a big baby. Sometimes he calls me 2 or 3 times in one day. When I tell him no, he withdraws and makes me feel guilty. I'm really at the end of my rope." When I met with Katie for the first time and requested clarification, I heard more of the same. "What is your problem as you see it?" "Katie, my problem is that my father doesn't realize I have my own life. He thinks my world should revolve around him. Since my mother's death, he uses me to fill in the empty space and take over." "What specifically have you said to your father about the problem?" Katie. "Father, you have to realize that I have my own life and that you're asking too much. I wish you would stop making me feel guilty when I don't come around. I think you need to get out and meet people and not just isolate yourself and rely on me." "How does your father respond to this?" Katie. "He gets upset and won't speak to me for a while. Or sometimes he starts talking about his poor health and he makes me feel so guilty that it's not worth it." "What do you do then?" Katie. "Nothing. Nothing works. That's why I'm here." What was striking, and also quite typical, about Katie's brief synopsis was that everything she said was about her father. "My father doesn't realize I have my own life. My father thinks my world should revolve around him. My father uses me. My father asks too much. My father makes me feel guilty. My father needs to get out and meet people." Katie is doing what most of us do when we are angry. She is judging, blaming, criticizing, moralizing, preaching, instructing, interpreting, and psychoanalyzing. There is not one statement from Katie that is truly about her own self. As you read ahead, keep in mind the lessons you have learned from the previous chapters. Katie's problem with her father has certain similarities to Maggie's problem with her mother. Struggle a bit with your own thoughts and reactions to the questions that follow before reading mine. Is Katie's father wrong to make such demands? I don't know. Who among us can say with certainty how many demands this particular 72-year-old widowed father should rightfully make on his grown daughter? If we were to ask 10 different people for their opinion, we might get 10 different answers, depending on the respondent's age, religion, nationality, socioeconomic class, sibling position, and family background. If I were in Katie's shoes, I would probably also complain that my father was too demanding. But that's because I'm me. Another person in the same spot might feel happy to be so needed. If we are searching for the ultimate truth of the matter, how much should a parent ask, how much should a daughter give, we may be failing to appreciate that there are multiple ways of perceiving the same situation, and that people think, feel, and react differently. If I persist in repeating this point, it's because it is an extremely difficult concept to grasp and hold on to when we are angry. Conflicting wants and different perceptions of the world do not mean that one party is right and the other is wrong. Does Katie have a right to be angry? Is her anger at her father legitimate? Of course. As I stated earlier, feeling angry is neither right nor wrong, legitimate or illegitimate. We have a right to everything we feel, and Katie's anger deserves her attention and respect. But Katie's right to be angry does not mean that her father is to blame. Rather, Katie's chronic anger and resentment is a signal that she needs to reevaluate her participation in her interactions with her father and consider how she might move differently in this important relationship. What's wrong with Katie's communications to her dad? For starters, Katie is not being particularly tactful or strategic. Few people are able to listen well when they are being criticized or told what's wrong with them. Unless Katie has a remarkably flexible father, her statements are likely to elicit further defensiveness on his part and make it less likely that she will be heard. Second, Katie's communications convey that she is an expert on her father's experience. Katie diagnoses her father as a selfish, neurotic, and demanding man who is using his daughter to fill up the empty space left by his deceased wife. This psychological interpretation may or may not fit. There are countless other possible explanations for father's behavior as well. Diagnosing the other person is a favorite pastime for most of us when stress is high. Although it can reflect a wish to provide a truly helpful insight, more often it is a subtle form of blaming and one-upsmanship. When we diagnose, we assume that we can know what another person really thinks, feels, or wants, or how the other person should think, feel, or behave. But we can't know these things for sure. It is difficult enough to know these things about our own selves. Who has the problem? My father has a big problem. He makes excessive demands on me. These statements, Katie's opening words to me on the phone, reflect her conviction that it is her father who has the problem. And yet from Katie's description, her father is able to identify his wishes, state them clearly, and even get what he wants. Katie has the problem. She has yet to find a way to identify and clarify her own limits with her father so that she is not left feeling bitter and resentful. It is Katie who is struggling and in pain. This is her problem. To say that Katie has a problem, however, is not to imply that she is wrong or to blame or at fault. Who has the problem is a question that has nothing to do with guilt or culpability. The one who has the problem is simply the party who is dissatisfied with or troubled by a particular situation. What is Katie's problem? Katie's problem is that she has not sorted out some major questions in her own mind. What is my responsibility for my own life? And what is my responsibility toward my father? What is being selfish, and what is being true to my own wants and priorities? What amount of help can I give to my father without feeling angry or resentful? Not until she comes up with clear-cut answers to these difficult questions can she meet her father on a different plane. Katie's problem is not that her father makes her feel guilty. Another person cannot make us feel guilty. They can only try. Katie's father will predictably give her a hard time if she shifts the old pattern, but she alone is responsible for her own feelings, guilt included. Surely there are no simple answers. What would your reaction be if Katie were to clarify new limits with her father? Would you view her as selfish, or would you cheer her new claim to selfhood? Who knows? How many of us can distinguish with confidence where our responsibilities to others begin and end? How can women, trained from birth to define ourselves through our loving care of others, know with confidence when it is time to finally say enough? A woman's work is never done, was the credo that Katie had lived out with her children, and now that the youngest was leaving home, she was continuing the drama with her elderly father. Katie, I learned, had been giving for most of her life, as her mother and grandmother had before her. Deep down, she felt too scared and guilty to reveal that long-buried part of herself that wanted to put forth her own needs and begin to take. Katie had devoted herself so exclusively to the needs of others that she had betrayed, if not lost, her own self. She felt the rage of her buried self, but hadn't yet been able to use it in order to make changes. No matter how much we sympathize or identify with Katie's situation, it is her problem nonetheless. This is not to imply that Katie is neurotic, misguided, or wrong, nor is it to say that she is the cause of her dilemma. The rules and roles of our families and society make it especially difficult for women to define ourselves apart from the wishes and expectations of others. And negative reactions from others, when we begin to pay primary attention to the quality and direction of our own lives, may certainly invite us to become anxious and guilty. If, however, we do not use our anger to define ourselves clearly in every important relationship we are in, and manage our feelings as they arise, no one else will assume this responsibility for us. Harnessing unclarity. Katie sought my help because she wanted to do something with her father, and she wanted me to tell her what that something was. The fact of the matter was that Katie, like most women, had more than enough people telling her what to do. Her mother, by example, had taught her that selflessness, self-sacrifice, and service were a woman's calling. And now Katie's friends were telling her that self-assertion was the key to her liberation. "Don't say yes when you really mean no," was the most oft-repeated statement that Katie heard from her advisors, until she herself began to believe that her problem might be solved if she could only find the courage to mutter this unspeakable two-letter word. What Katie really needed to do was to calm down and do nothing, at least for a while. It is not wise to make decisions or to attempt to change a relationship at a time when we are feeling angry and intense. Also, Katie has really not thought very much about her situation because she is too busy reacting to it. Katie would get off to a good start if she stopped blaming and diagnosing her father. She could begin to recognize that it is her job to separate herself a bit from his wishes and expectations in order to clarify her own values, to evaluate her own choices and priorities, and to make decisions regarding what she will and will not do. Katie could also recognize that she is not yet clear about these things and does not know how to solve her problem. Acknowledging our unclarity is in itself a significant step. What could Katie do next? What can any of us do when we feel angry in reaction to demands being placed upon us, but see no new options for changing our behavior? Our anger signals a problem, but it provides us with no answers, not even a clue as to how to solve it. Anger is simply something we feel or allow ourselves to feel. At the same time it tells us that we need to slow down and think more clearly about the self, our anger can make clear thinking difficult indeed. At this point, Katie's task is not to do something with her anger, although criticizing her father and inviting others to do the same may bring her short-term relief, or at least a sense of moral superiority. In terms of lasting change, Katie's job is to strive to achieve a lower degree of emotional reactivity and a higher degree of self-clarity. How? Katie will become clearer about her convictions and options if she does the following. First, she can share her problem with other family members, including her father. Second, she can gather data about how other relatives, especially the women in her family, have dealt with similar problems over the generations. "Dad, I have a problem." When Katie told her father a little about her problem, it was a high-anxiety moment, and no less significant than Maggie's talk with her mother. By calmly sharing something about where she stood on an emotional issue in the family, Katie shifted the old rigid pattern in the relationship. The conversation went something like this. "You know, Dad, I have a problem. I haven't figured out how to balance the responsibility I feel toward you and the responsibility I feel toward myself. Last week when I took you shopping 2 times and also drove you to your doctor's appointment, I found myself feeling tense and uncomfortable because I really wanted some of that time just for me. But when I say no and go about my own personal business, I end up feeling guilty, like I'm looking over my shoulder to see how you're doing. Well, if I'm that much of a burden, I can just stay away," Father said coldly. He looked as if he had been physically struck. Katie had prepared herself for her father's counter moves so that she could stand her ground when they came, without getting sucked into that intense field of emotional reactivity that characterized their relationship. "No, Dad," she replied, "I wouldn't want that. I'm not saying that you are burdening me. In fact, I would like to get a little better myself at asking people for help. What I'm talking about is my problem, getting clear about what feels comfortable for me. I need to figure out how much I can do for you and when I need to say no and put myself first." "Katie, you surprise me," said her father. "Your mother took care of both her parents when they were old, and she never complained about it. Your mother would certainly not be very proud of you." "I know what you mean, Dad." Katie refused to bite the bait, and she continued to calmly address her own issue. "I was always impressed by Mom's willingness to take care of both her parents. It seemed to me that she had an amazing capacity to be giving without feeling short-changed or resentful. But I'm not Mom. I'm different, and I really don't think I could do that. I guess I am more selfish than Mother was." There was an awkward silence, which her father broke. "Well, Katie, is there something I'm supposed to do about this problem of yours?" The mixture of sarcasm and hurt in his voice couldn't be missed. For a moment, Katie felt that old pressure to give her father advice and suggest ways that he could meet people and make use of the resources available to him. She knew from experience, however, that it didn't work. Instead, she stayed on course and continued to discuss her own problem. "I wish someone else could solve my problem and make my decisions for me. But I know that's really my job." Katie became thoughtful. "Actually, Dad, it would be helpful to me, in my attempts to get clear about all this, if you could share some of your own experience with me. Have you ever struggled with anything like this? What was it like for you when your mother became ill and couldn't take care of herself anymore? Who in the family made the decision to put her in the nursing home? And what was your perspective on that?" By directly addressing a family issue, in this case, who takes care of an elderly parent, rather than angrily reacting to it, Katie detoxified the subject by getting it out on the table. As a result, the underground anxiety that surrounds unaddressed emotional issues will diminish, and Katie will find that she is able to think more objectively about her situation. In addition, Katie is beginning to question her dad about his own experience with elderly parents. Learning how other family members have handled problems similar to our own, down through the generations, is one of the most effective routes to lowering reactivity and heightening self-clarity. In fact, before Katie could initiate this talk with her dad in so solid a fashion, she had to learn more about the legacy of caretaking in her family background. Learning about our legacy. Which women in Katie's extended family have struggled with a similar problem, and how have they attempted to solve it? How have other women in Katie's family, her sister, aunts, and grandmothers, balanced their responsibility to others with their responsibility to themselves? How successful have they been? How did it happen that Katie's mother took on the sole responsibility of caring for her aging parents? What is the perspective of her mother's sister and brothers about how well this arrangement worked out? How did decisions get made, down through the generations, about who took care of family members who were not able to care for themselves? We are never the first in our family to wrestle with the problem, although it may feel that way, All of us inherit the unsolved problems of our past, and whatever we are struggling with has its legacy in the struggles of prior generations. If we do not know about our own family history, we are more likely to repeat past patterns or mindlessly rebel against them without much clarity about who we really are, how we are similar to and different from other family members, and how we might best proceed in our own life. Using our anger effectively requires first and foremost a clear eye. And women have been blocked from selfhood at every turn. We cannot hope to realize the self, however, in isolation from individuals on our family tree. No book, or psychotherapist for that matter, can help us with this task if we stay cut off from our roots. Most of us react strongly to family members, especially our mothers, but we do not talk to them in depth and gather data about their experience. We may know virtually nothing about the forces that shaped our parents' lives as they shaped ours, or how our mothers and grandmothers dealt with problems similar to ours. When we do not know these things, we do not know the self. And without a clear self, rooted in our history, we will be prone to intense, angry reactions in all sorts of situations, in response to which we will blame others, distance ourselves, passively comply, or otherwise spin our wheels. And so, Katie had some family work to do. She contacted a wide representation of family members, especially the women, and learned firsthand about their experience and perspective as they grappled with issues not unlike her own. From living family members, she learned more about those who had died, including her mother. In so doing, Katie was able to see her problem with her father in its broader context. Katie discovered that women in her family tended to fall into two opposite camps. Those who, like her mother, made large personal sacrifices to care for aging parents and grandparents, and those who, like her mother's sister, Aunt Peggy, stuck their heads in the sand as aging family members became unable to care for themselves. Within these camps were several warring factions. Katie's mother, for example, did not speak to her sister for several years following their mother's death, because she felt that Peggy had not pitched in her share of the caretaking. From Peggy's perspective, Katie's mother had made unilateral and unwise decisions about their mother's care. Caring for elderly parents had been such a loaded issue in the previous generations that it was predictable that Katie would have a hard time finding a middle ground and striking a comfortable balance between her responsibility for herself and her responsibility to her father. As Katie connected to her family and gathered information, she felt calmer about her situation and was able to think about new options for herself with her father, where before she had been convinced that none were possible. There were no easy answers or painless solutions. Katie once summarized her dilemma this way: "No matter how long I'm in therapy, I'm still going to feel guilty if I say no to my father. But if I keep saying yes, I'm going to feel angry. So, if I'm going to change, I guess I will just have to learn to live with some guilt for a while." This is exactly what Katie did. She lived with some guilt, which did not prove fatal, and which eventually subsided. The specific changes that Katie made with her father may seem small and unimpressive to an outsider. She decided to have dinner with him twice rather than three times a week, and told him that she would shop for him on Saturday rather than on an on-call basis during the week. These were the only changes that she initiated, but she held to them, and they made a big difference in her life. Soon thereafter, her father initiated a change of his own. He became good friends with an older woman in his neighborhood, and they would talk for several hours each day. Katie felt reassured, but also disquieted by this event. She began to realize how much her preoccupation with her father had organized her life, and helped her to avoid confronting her isolation from her own peers. She also learned that she was far more skilled at giving help than asking for it. The specifics of what Katie decided to do and not do for her father is the least important part of her story. Katie's solution would not necessarily be the right one for you or me. What is more significant is the work that she did in her own family, which gave her a greater sense of connectedness to her roots and of her separateness and clarity as an individual. Now she could better use her anger as a springboard for thinking about her situation rather than remaining a victim of it. And as we will see, thinking clearly about the questions, what am I responsible for, and what am I not responsible for, is a difficult challenge for all of us. Chapter 7. Who's responsible for what? The trickiest anger question. While attending a conference in New York one spring, I rode by bus to the Metropolitan Museum with two colleagues. I had lost my old familiarity with the city, and my companions, Celia and Janet, felt like foreigners in a strange land. Perhaps as a result of our big city anxiety, we reminded the bus driver, once too often, to announce our stop. In a sudden and unexpected fury, he launched into a vitriolic attack that turned heads throughout the crowded bus. The three of us stood in stunned silence. Later, over coffee, we shared our personal reactions to this incident. Celia felt mildly depressed. She was reminded of her abusive ex-husband, and this particular week was the anniversary of their divorce. Janet reacted with anger, which seemed to dissipate as she drummed up clever retorts to the driver's outburst and hilarious revenge fantasies. My own reaction was nostalgia. I had been feeling homesick for New York and almost welcomed the contrast to the Midwestern politeness to which I had become accustomed. It was a New York City happening that I could take back to Topeka, Kansas. Suppose we reflect briefly on this incident. We might all agree that the bus driver behaved badly, but is he also responsible for the reactions of three women? Did he cause Celia's depression and Janet's anger? Did he make me feel nostalgic for my past? And if one of us had reacted to this man's surliness by jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge that night, should he be held accountable for a death? Or viewed from another perspective, were we responsible for his outburst to begin with? It is tempting to view human transactions in simple cause-and-effect terms. If we are angry, someone else caused it. Or if we are the target of someone else's anger, we must be to blame. Or, alternately, if we are convinced of our innocence, we may conclude that the other person has no right to feel angry. The more our relationships in our first family are fused, meaning the togetherness force is so powerful that there is a loss of the separate I's within the we, the more we learn to take responsibility for other people's feelings and reactions and blame them for our own. You always make Mom feel guilty. You give Dad headaches. She caused her husband to drink. Likewise, family members assume responsibility for causing other people's thoughts, feelings, and behavior. Human relationships, however, don't work that way, or at least not very well. We begin to use our anger as a vehicle for change when we are able to share our reactions without holding the other person responsible for causing our feelings, and without blaming ourselves for the reactions that other people have in response to our choices and actions. We are responsible for our own behavior, but we are not responsible for other people's reactions, nor are they responsible for ours. Women often learn to reverse this order of things. We put our energy into taking responsibility for other people's feelings, thoughts, and behavior, and hand over to others responsibility for our own. When this happens, it becomes difficult, if not impossible, for the old rules of a relationship to change. To illustrate the point, let's return to Katie's problem with her widowed father, whom she initially described as excessively demanding and guilt-inducing. If Katie perceives her father as unilaterally causing her anger and/or guilt, she is at a dead end. She will feel helpless and powerless because she cannot change him. Similarly, if Katie takes responsibility for causing her father's feelings and reactions, she is also stuck. Why? Because if Katie does not make a change in the status quo, her father will become emotionally reactive to her new behavior. If Katie then feels responsible for causing his reactions, she may reinstate the old pattern in order to protect her father and herself from uncomfortable feelings and to safeguard the predictable sameness of the relationship. My father got so angry and crazy when I said no that there was just nothing I could do. The situation is then defined as hopeless. Why is the question, who is responsible for what, such a puzzle for women? Women in particular have been discouraged from taking responsibility for solving our own problems, determining our own choices, and taking control of the quality and direction of our own lives. As we learn to relinquish responsibility for the self, we are prone to blame others for failing to fill up our emptiness or provide for our happiness, which is not their job. At the same time, however, we may feel responsible for just about everything that goes on around us. We are quick to be blamed for other people's problems and pain, and quick to accept the verdict of guilty. We also, in the process, develop the belief that we can avert problems if only we try hard enough. Indeed, guilt and self-blame are a woman's problem of epidemic proportion. A colleague tells the story of pausing on a ski slope to admire the view, only to be knocked down by a careless skier who apparently did not notice her. "I'm sorry," she reflexively yelled after him, from her prone position as he whizzed on by. In this chapter, we will see how confusion about who is responsible for what is one source of non-productive self-blaming and other blaming, as well as a roadblock to changing our situation. How can we learn to take more responsibility for the self and less for the thoughts, feelings, and behavior of others? At this point, you should be clearer on the subject than when you started out, but let's continue to try our hand at sorting out the elements of this perplexing question. Remember, assuming responsibility for the self means not only clarifying the I, but also observing and changing our part in the patterns that keep us stuck. In this chapter, we will be looking carefully at the over-functioning, under-functioning patterns in which we all participate. A Crisis at Midnight. Jane and Stephanie have lived together for 8 years and have raised a German shepherd who is a much-loved member of their household. One evening, the dog woke them in the middle of the night and was obviously quite ill. Stephanie thought that the situation was serious enough to warrant an immediate call to the vet. Jane insisted that it could wait till morning. She accused Stephanie of being excessively worried and overreactive. When they awoke the next morning, their dog's condition had worsened. When the veterinarian examined him, she said, "You should have called me immediately. Your dog could have died." Stephanie was furious at Jane. "If anything had happened," she said, "you would have been to blame." What is your perspective on this situation? How would you react if you were in Stephanie's shoes at this point? How do you view the responsibility of each party in contributing to Stephanie's anger? We may empathize with Stephanie's anger, but she is nonetheless confused about who is responsible for what. Let's analyze the situation in more detail. It is Jane's responsibility to clarify her beliefs and take action in accord with them. She did this. It was her opinion that the dog did not need immediate medical attention, and so she did not call the doctor. Stephanie, too, is responsible for clarifying her beliefs and acting upon them. She did not do this. She was worried that the dog might need immediate attention, and still she did not call the vet. I am not suggesting that Stephanie should not feel angry with Jane. If she is angry, she is angry. She may be angry that Jane put down her fears, minimized her concerns, disqualified her perception of reality, or acted like